Walter Auditorium or viewing tonight's program via the World Wide Web. I'm Alan Pally, and I'm producer of public programs for the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. In September, we inaugurated A Rose by Any Other Name, our series of programs exploring adaptations of Shakespeare. We opened the series with Arthur Lawrence, librettist for West Side Story. We also presented live from Lincoln Center's John Goberman, who introduced a screening of the Kenneth Macmillan ABT Romeo and Juliet. Tonight, we present New York City Ballet's Ballet Master-in-Chief in a talk focusing on his extraordinary new production of Romeo and Juliet, which premiered at the New York City Ballet last spring and which returns to the repertory in January 2008. We're very much looking forward to that. I want to thank our generous friends at the New York City Ballet, with whom this library, and in particular our dance division, enjoys a close relationship, for their assistance in arranging tonight's program. Before I introduce tonight's guests, I'd like to tell you about our two concluding programs in the Shakespeare adaptation series. On Monday, December 10th, we will be presenting a reading of Bernard Shaw's rewritten last act of Shakespeare's Cymbeline. Shaw loved the play, and he hated the last act, so he rewrote it. It will be directed by Charlotte Moore and star Fritz Weaver as Cymbeline, so we hope you come and visit again. On Wednesday, December 12th, the final program in this series will feature the great piano vocalist Dick Hyman, who will perform his songs set to Shakespeare's texts. And now, please welcome the Ballet Master-in-Chief of the New York City Ballet and choreographer of Romeo and Juliet, Peter Martins, and the arts editor of the New York Sun, Pia Catton. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Performing Arts Library for hosting this event. I'd like to organize the event into three main sections and talk a little bit about the set design and the visuals, to go on then to the narrative and the choreographic choices, and then the music. But before we do that... What's that? Okay. Okay. Before we do that, let's just place this ballet in the context of your work and the New York City Ballet repertory. The ballet is a company that does not do all that many full-length narrative ballets. Why did you want to create a new evening-length ballet?
Can you hear me? Okay. Well, there are many, many, many reasons going into a decision as to what is your next ballet. But specifically about your question about why a full length for the New York City Ballet. You know, long before New York City Ballet became part of my life in a real sense, when I was a very young guy, I, like many young people who aspire to choreograph, Romeo and Juliet is always on the horizon. You always consider it one day. But looking at the landscape and looking at all the Romeos around the world, I always decided, well, who needs another one? Unless you somehow have a different approach and a different vision for it. And it takes sometimes many, many years. And in this case, it took, 25 years for me to finally get to the point where I thought, maybe I'm ready. Maybe this is the time when I will do my Romeo. For many reasons. So that's the sort of short answer.
Okay. What were those kind of reasons?
Well, I will try to make them short, the answers. One was casting. I didn't want to do a Romeo and Juliet with a 40-year-old grand ballerina and a 45-year-old grand ballerino. I wanted young people. And sometimes you have to wait for young people to emerge. And last year, all of a sudden, not that there haven't been young people emerging in the past, but for some reason, they were all there. All the Juliets, the Romeos, the Mercutios, they just emerged. So that's one reason. Another reason was that you need a setting. What is this going to look like? Who is going to design this? Is it going to look grand and grandiose with chandeliers and staircases, or is it going to be a different approach? And that's what we'll talk about, Pierre Kirkeby, my painter friend. Another thing is sort of, I don't know if the word is societal issues, like the way people go to the theater today. You know, sometimes when I go to the ballet or to the opera, I cannot spend 3.5 hours in the theater. I just can't. I fall asleep. Almost it doesn't matter how great it is. I just can't. I want to see it fast. I want to see it, get it over with, done with quickly. And so there's this whole issue of what is the theater-going experience like this day and age? Do you go and, I mean, you go and see Wagner, you have to spend 4 hours. So there are those issues. And also music issues. I've loved this score for years, but I've always thought that there was so much repetitiveness in it. Why can't people cut the repeats? So I did.
Good.
A lot of them, anyway.
For those in the audience who have not seen the ballet and your production of it, let's set the stage a little bit and tell the audience what you see when you enter the theater and then the curtains are pulled back. And what is the first image that the audience is greeted with?
Yeah. You see a device. I call it a device. You see a unit, for lack of a better term. It evokes a building in the town of Verona, somewhat abstractly, which then, in the course of the evening, will transform itself to become a bedroom of Juliet. It'll become a ballroom. It'll become a balcony scene. It'll go back to become a street scene, a different place in the town of Verona. It'll become, ultimately, a tomb. And all of this takes place within one confined unit that changes and becomes various things in front of your eyes.
You developed this device along with the Danish artist Pierre Kirkeby, who you have worked with in the past. He designed your sets and costumes for Swan Lake. So let's talk a little bit about the creative process of working with Pierre Kirkeby, who we both agree is a brilliant painter.
Yes, indeed. I went to Pierre, and I, after Swan Lake, I said to him, you know, let's take a break, and maybe one day we will get together and we'll do something else. And we both had the idea of doing Romeo and Juliet together sort of separately, and we met, and it sort of all came together. And I presented this idea to him of this unit. And the inspiration, I think, is important to point out, is Balanchine's Prodigal Son. I think all of you have seen Prodigal Son, right? There's this wonderful unit. It serves many purposes. It's a table. It's a fence. It's a boat. And it's ingeniously conceived by Balanchine. And I took that as my inspiration for this thing that also could change from one scene to another without having a black curtain come down and having scenery change behind the curtain and some music being played for the mere purpose of scenery change. I wanted it all to happen in front of your eyes. So I had this device that I presented to him, and he liked it. And we just clicked, and he was on board.
How long did it take to work out these visual ideas?
I would say maybe a year and a half.
And what did that consist of? You went to see him in Denmark. How did you work together?
Yes, I went with him. I went to Denmark, and I presented all these ideas, and we worked out of his house. And we had a little model of the whole thing that he painted, miniature, doll's house. And everything was worked out right there. He would take scissors out, and he would stub, and we would tear things apart, and we would rebuild. And everything happened in a little doll's house. So it was all conceived of like all theater productions are. And then you run it, and you time it, and you put music on, and you do how long it takes to do this and how long it takes to do this. And it's all theoretical.
When you discussed the idea of the ballet with him, was there anything from the play that he wanted to represent in his paintings, or anything that he felt strongly about representing as a visual artist?
Yes. Blood. He asked me, what is Romeo and Juliet about to you, Peter, in one sentence? And I said, it's tragic love. It's really tragic love. Not necessarily romantic love, tragic love. And you're a big fan of his.
I am.
And he's very, I don't know what the word is. He's bold, I think the word is. And he wanted the scene to open with blood. He wanted, instead of having this beautiful overture where you sort of see a landscape and a beautiful traditional introduction to a ballet, he wanted drama. And that's why the first drop he painted was really about blood.
That relates to a lot of what he works on in terms of color.
Yes.
I mean, it's very red.
Yes.
And also his paintings have a great deal to do with nature. Is that represented in the ballet?
I think so.
In what way?
Well, he has an outdoor drop. He has an indoor drop. He has a night sky. I mean, he's actually a landscape painter, a modernist, but he's a geologist, as you know.
Mm-hmm. I think some of that comes through in terms of the stone. It's a very
yes.
There's a strong feeling of the stone and the structure of the castle, the room, the tomb, that kind of thing. Let's go on now to talk a little bit about the narrative and your casting decisions. It took months to work out these visual ideas. How then did you approach the ideas that are contained in the play? How did you choose to tell this story?
Well, I wanted to pare it down to the bare essentials. I didn't want lots of mime that people couldn't, that looked like sign language for the modern day audiences. I wanted to make it very concise and very clear that when you have a gesture as a dancer, that it was really legible, that you could understand what it meant. So I sort of came up with my own mime language based on a traditional Mayan language that I learned in Denmark. But I sort of updated it, if you will.
Are there any specific examples that you'd like to share?
I couldn't tell you. I'll have to show you.
Okay. I have to go see the ballet. Did you spend a lot of time reading the play?
Yes, I did. And it was clear to me that this was tragic. It was youth. It was passion. It was rage. It was all those things. You know, there was somewhat controversy about the rage that Romeo displayed when his friend Mercutio was killed, but the play very clearly describes how Romeo simply just lost himself. He, you know, nobody could recognize Romeo. He just became a monster, and I wanted very much to portray that.
Now, you were saying earlier that suddenly you felt that you had the people who could portray these characters. What was the character that you were looking for?
Well, I actually didn't know whether they could portray them, because I didn't know whether they could act. But I knew they had the youth, they had the innocence, and they could dance it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted this to be dancing. I didn't want this to be just walking around and parading. Mm-hmm. I wanted very much that this be a dancing production.
So let's talk about your casting process. Initially, you had thought about casting some very young Juliets. And eventually you did cast very young Juliet. How did that idea evolve?
Well, I was teaching at the School of American Ballet about a year earlier, and I saw four girls in one class that were 16 years old, 15, 16, 17 years old, and I thought, there are four Juliets who could do it like this. So I started the ballet on those girls. I started choreographing on them. And then various things happened, injuries and so forth, so I ended up actually using one of them.
And who were the lead dancers that you did use?
Ultimately, I chose Sterling Hilton. and Robbie Fairchild, two young dancers in the New York City Ballet, to do the first performance. And they were 20, 19, 20, 21, and they looked every bit 16.
Yes, they did. What are some of the characteristics that make a great Juliet for your production?
I don't want to give you a quick a contradictory answer, but I would say the inability to act.
It sounds sort of funny.
It sounds contradictory. Yeah. I didn't want somebody with acting skills who can portray a role. I wanted somebody who could just be. And there's a great difference. You know, everybody talks about how great Margot Fonteyn was. She was 42 years old, and she could portray a 16-year-old like nobody. And she certainly could, and it was phenomenal. But that didn't interest me. I wanted somebody who simply was, just stood there awkwardly, incapable. And yet, when you're that young, you can't fake it. You are. And that's what I was going for.
Right now, the boys at City Ballet are extremely strong and more polished than ever. Did their technique have any impact on your choreography for the men in the production?
Absolutely. They're so much better now than they were in my days.
Except for you.
No. Are you kidding? When I came, I was the only one who could do certain things. Now everybody can do it. No. It's a whole different time.
And is that part of, would you say that's a result of the boys' program?
You know, many things. It's evolution. I think it's just called evolution. I think people get better at anything. You know, Roger Federer can beat Pete Sampras now. You like tennis, any of you? Hi.
Now, to dance the roles of Juliet's parents, you asked principal dancer Darcy Kistler and the then recently retired Jacques Soto. Why did you make those choices?
Well, first of all, the production premiered in celebration of Lincoln Kirstein. So I was very much trying to bring people from the school and the company together. And Darcy, my wife, teaches at SAB, so does Jacques Soto, and they were the teachers of the Juliets. And I wanted very much for them to be part of this production. So I asked them, and they happily accepted. And I also wanted them to be young. I mean, they're relatively young. Mm-hmm. And not some, you know, old ballet mistress who's been around for years and you have to utilize her. And so, you know, I wanted it to be young because in the play, Lady Capulet gave birth to Juliet when she was 17 herself. Mm-hmm. So I wanted it to be a relatively young woman.
That relates to another point in the production that makes it differ from others. The nurse and the friar in your ballet are quite young and attractive.
That's right.
So what was your thinking in casting for those roles?
Well, I was also a little bit sly. You know, I wanted Nikolai Huber because he's a great...
Most people do.
Yeah, he has great presence. And the friar in Romeo and Juliet, I've always felt it is probably the most difficult role to portray because it's so subtle and you just have to be and stand and be able to convey all these emotions that the friar goes through without acting, overacting, which I often see. I wanted him to be able to understand that, and Nikolai was perfect for that. And the nurse, I always see these nurses in productions who are 50-year-old women like this, and I wanted a young nurse at the same age of Juliet, which was what Shakespeare called for. Mm-hmm. So very similar in age.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose a young nurse. Sexy nurse.
Sexy nurse, she is. there's also a very streamlined cast here. There's not a ton of villagers on stage. There's not a ton of Romeo's buddies or Juliet's extraneous friends. And there's also no Montague parents.
There are no Montague parents.
Where are that boy's parents?
Which are the Romeo parents, because they don't figure prominently in the play. Mm-hmm. They have a very little role, mm-hmm. other than names.
That's true.
So, and many productions don't have them either. And I musically, there's no room for them. Mm-hmm. It's all the Capulets, mm-hmm. the Capulets parties, and so forth.
And as far as the villagers and the...
The villagers, I didn't want kids walk around with apple carts and all that stuff. I wanted people in the village to dance. That's where I think it was the New York City Ballet came into the picture. I wanted them to dance, not just walk around mm-hmm. and sweep the streets. Also, they would have refused to.
I doubt that. When you think about Romeo and Juliet, what is the central problem that you wanted to portray on stage?
Well, I mean, the play says it all. You know, young lovers who simply lose perception of reality. Just love just takes over. We've all been there, I think. Haven't you? But it is portrayed better. I mean, he told the story better than anybody. I mean, it could happen. It's happening at this very moment somewhere. And it's what leads people to, you know, when emotions take over and you don't use your mind and your judgment is based on what you feel, you often get in real trouble. And that's that story.
At the end of the play, in your production, you have the characters come to the tomb. Almost the entire cast comes out to the tomb and sees and sort of witnesses, takes responsibility. Was that a choreographic choice? Was that a sort of more storytelling choice?
I think it's probably more choreographic image choice. You know, I mean, when you do something like Romeo and Juliet, or for that matter, any play, I think you have to take some liberties. You know, if you go by the text verbatim, I think you may run into trouble. So I think you have to take some liberties.
Mm-hmm. There are some versions
from a theatrical conception. Mm-hmm.
There are some versions in which she wakes up, and he is still there. But he has taken the poison, he dies, and then she kills herself. Did you think about that version at all? Or
I don't know what version you're talking about. There's the Shakespeare version, which is what I did, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, but I did contemplate, because I think maybe some of you have read that there was some music discovered recently that Prokofiev wrote for the original ending, which was a happy ending, and I discarded that because it didn't appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. Did you go and see the Shakespeare in the Park Romeo and Juliet?
No, I didn't.
Do you have some other versions of Romeo and Juliet that you enjoy watching?
The Zeffirelli mm-hmm. movie, I liked it very much.
Mm-hmm. And
but that also was about youth mm-hmm. and innocence, and you know, that's what appealed to me. Mm-hmm.
Let's go on to the music. You decided to use the Prokofiev score, and did you eliminate or rearrange anything? You alluded to this in the beginning.
I didn't eliminate anything, except there was one little dance, a 2.5-minute dance, that didn't fit in my scenario, and I eliminated it. It's a nice little tune, and I think he'll forgive me. But the rest is intact. There's nothing omitted other than repeats. A number of repeats, and I did my research and discovered that a lot of the repeats that we see in all these versions currently everywhere were there as a theatrical device prescribed by the choreographer Larovsky, because he needed it for scenery change. And since I didn't have that problem, I didn't want scenery changes happening behind a black curtain and 45 seconds of going through your playbill or whatever. I wanted it in front of us, so it was a lot of music I didn't need. So I spent a long time, 3 or 4 months, really restructuring the music and yet keep its integrity.
Are there any recordings that you listen to particularly and that you like?
I think Simon Rattle comes to mind. I liked his tempos.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about tempo for a moment. I'm sure that the company's conductor had some thoughts. And what were your conversations like? I'm sure that's a collaborative effort in some respects.
No, it wasn't.
No?
No. I told him, this is what I want. And he went, fine. No. I'm teasing. No, of course it is. But we agreed basically on everything. There was no issues.
What were some of the, what were the things to agree on?
I actually conceived of this with Richard Mordock, who's our musical genius in house at the New York City Ballet. He and I worked for 3 months, and we came up with a version, and he would go on his computer and he would put it together. And I also only wanted one intermission. I didn't want two intermissions. So you end up essentially with 2 hours worth of music as opposed to 2.5 hours worth of music. And I showed that. I gave that CD music to my music director for him to listen to and feedback. Mm-hmm. And he loved every decision.
That's great.
So.
Yeah. You considered using Tchaikovsky and also considered using the Berlioz, I think?
Yeah. I did. I did that because I thought the New York City Ballet is the house of Tchaikovsky. And I've loved Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet for many, many years, but as you many of you know, it's only a 20-minute suite. It certainly doesn't sustain a full-length ballet, and I thought maybe I could bring other Tchaikovsky from various other sources and make a full-length ballet based on Tchaikovsky. But I thought ultimately it would end up being a pastiche. Mm-hmm. And a mishmash. Mm-hmm. So I abandoned that. And the Berlioz I loved, but I didn't. The voice, the singing, I thought was not conducive to a ballet.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite portion of the score?
Yes. I actually do. You mean musically?
Musically. Mm-hmm.
The Capulet dance in the ballroom. Mm-hmm. I think it's magnificent.
And can you describe how you thought through the process of the choreography for that section?
I wanted it to be very minimal. It's mm-hmm. it's a minimalistic choreographic conceit. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be overly choreographed, so it's very simple because I wanted to hear the music and I didn't want it to ornament it with too much stuff. Mm-hmm. Because there was plenty of costumes and scenery and lights and color, and I thought the choreography should be absolutely minimal. It would be the best thing.
And that carries through throughout the ballet.
It does.
In some ways. Does it?
Didn't know that.
But just in terms of, there's no sweeping of the floor by extraneous people. There are very clear dances.
I wanted this to be a ballet. It's a very balletic production. If you go around, there's a lot of dancing, and I wanted it to be about dancing. Otherwise, why do it?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back and talk a bit about dancing and the Mercutio role. How did you conceive his role and his dance?
Well, the music is fantastic for Mercutio, and I was lucky enough to have this dancer called Daniel Ulbricht, who is this phenomenal dancer, and he inspired that role totally. Mm-hmm. He just did.
In what way?
He can do anything. he can dance. He's athletic beyond belief. He's very creative, imaginative. He's very animated. He's a great sword fighter. There were no limitations to what I could do with that role. Mm-hmm. And so he made it his own.
Are there any specific steps that you gave him that no one else can do?
Yes.
Like what?
Everyone. I think everyone, basically. No, there are other people who can do it, but nobody can do it like him. I mean, he turns more, he jumps higher. But it's not just that. It's his he's so engaged in every moment.
Mm-hmm. If that is the case, why did you choose him for the role of Mercutio rather than Romeo?
Because he's not as poetic as I envisioned Romeo.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about Romeo for a minute and his poetic side.
Well, you know, Romeo is a dreamer. He just falls in love every other way, every other day. And I wanted somebody who was like that, and I found him. I don't know whether he falls in love every other day, but...
Do you have a particularly favorite part of your production?
The Capulet dance in the ballroom, mm-hmm. to me is, that's when I sort of go, wow, I think it is fantastic. I really do. I think the look of it, the costumes and the music, and I just think, to me, it's like, that's why I did it. It's fantastic.
What are those costumes like? Let's go back to that.
Well, they got absolutely ripped in the press, and I cannot imagine what kind of a taste. I even forget who ripped it. I don't, actually. But it's okay. I can't imagine how anybody with any sense of color can not like that look. It's the most beautiful palette, in my view.
And that palette is reds.
It's every color you can imagine, but it's put together so beautifully. It is overwhelmingly beautiful, and I think it is the highlight for me.
And those were designed by Pierre Kirkaby.
Yes,
in
all his
collaboration
colors.
With City
his
Ballet.
Colors.
With his colors.
No,
mm-hmm.
Pierre Kirkaby made the palette. I didn't mm-hmm. tell him anything.
Nothing.
So only one thing I objected to. I said to him, "Why does Tybalt have to look like a New York yellow cab?" Yellow and black. And he said, "You are such a coward." He said, "What do you want? To mute it down and make it a little, a Tuscan color, you know, like mm-hmm. mustard?" And I said, "Something like that." He said, "No. Yellow is evil. It's obstructionist. It has to be yellow. It has to slap you in your face." And I went, "Well, maybe you're right."
He's the painter.
So that was the one disagreement we have. But of course, he prevailed.
And how about the play? Do you have a favorite portion of the play when you would read through it? Is there something in the poem that you enjoy? Since this is a public library Shakespeare special.
You know, the one thing that intrigues me perhaps more than anything about this is when Father Lawrence decides that he has the answer to this problem. When Juliet comes to him and begs, I don't know what to do. I want to kill myself. And he goes, "No. Don't kill yourself. Pretend to kill yourself." That, to me, is really where the whole ballet begins, actually.
Did you talk through these ideas with the dancers before you entered the studio with them?
No.
They came to the studio.
No,
and then
I gave them a little fast-forward version of the whole play. And I didn't want to get too literal. I didn't want to talk about it too much because mm-hmm. they're very bright. They do their homework. Mm-hmm. And there was never any question as to what this was about. People mm-hmm. understood. Mm-hmm. When I was telling the story in mime and so mm-hmm. forth, they all understood.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel like this was an opportunity to transmit some of the lessons that you learned in Denmark to your dancers here, especially in terms of mime, limited mime, though? Or storytelling in general?
Yeah. Again, it sounds like a contradiction. I said earlier I didn't want people to act. What I mean by that is I didn't want them to overact. Obviously, you have to be able to convey emotion on stage. But it has to be done in such a way that it doesn't appear as acting. It's not unlike acting, mm-hmm. you know, in a play or in a film. You have to just become that person. And I didn't coach them. Much.
When you say coach, what does that mean?
I didn't say, you know, make that emotion or do this. And I let them be alone. And very, on rare occasions did I correct somebody. I wanted them to just find their own way.
Mm-hmm. And are you happy in general with the production? Are there things that you would change?
I'm totally happy in general with the production. Except the yellow cap. No, I still like. No, I like the yellow cap more and more.
Now, what do you do with the? You talked in the beginning about the miniature set that you created with Pierre Kirkby. Do you have that at home?
No, I have no idea where it is. I don't know where it is.
Were there any ideas that you had initially that you had to discard later, or throughout the process?
Yes, there were many. You know. It was very collaborative. It was myself, it was Pierre Kirkeby, and it was Perry Sylvie, who is our production stage manager of the New York City Ballet, and it was Mark Stanley, our lighting director. So the four of us spent a lot of time back and forth. I would have an idea, and I would think it would be great, and the three of them would say, Peter, this is terrible, and the idea would go away. And so that's how it all worked. Mm-hmm. It was all, it was very collaborative. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say by consensus, because there were times when I said, sorry, that's what I want. And they went, okay. And there was one time, I remember, when Pierre Kirkeby said to me, that is the worst idea I've ever heard you had. And I changed it, because he's very bright and he was right. I forget exactly what it was about. I just remember he said, no, dumb. Mm-hmm. So I think often the collaborative effort can produce much better work if people are able to put their egos aside. Often.
Now, in your work together in Denmark, would you? How much time did you spend on sort of each day? I mean, would you?
We'd spend 7-8 hours a day on the whole with that little model. Mm-hmm. Putting another backdrop in, another backdrop. I would say to Pierre Kirkeby, you know, why does that backdrop have to have that color? Can't you? I would tell him to paint differently, and he would go, maybe. And so it was like that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's always fascinated me when I go to the ballet is looking at those giant backdrops. When Kirkeby paints a sample or a small version, then how does it become a giant backdrop?
There's a formula, and I don't profess to know exactly what it is, but it's based on measurement, 1 inch, 1 foot. So you have this thing, you multiply it by so many feet, and then you get exactly the same thing. And so theater painters will then paint the drop exactly based on that little thing.
And I believe that Pierre Kirkeby came to New York to take a look.
Touch.
Yeah, and when he is here to sort of see things, do you continue to talk about the set? Are there changes that are still in process?
Absolutely.
At that point,
yeah. You know? He would come. Obviously, he was here, and he would go up, and he would put on his painter clothes, and he would take a big brush, and he would fix it. You know. And just to give his own little final touch.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that that we didn't cover that you think is particularly important?
Well, you know, it's so new. It's only, 6 months old, this production. And you asked me if there were things I wanted to change, and I was very quick to say no. I was being slightly funny. I mean, I'm anxious to see it again in January, and I'm sure there will be things I will change because it all evolves, and I would hope that there would be things I would change, that I would make better. But the real question is, you know, that I can't answer. This public can't. The real question is whether it has a place, ultimately, and only time can tell. But for me, I am extremely happy with the outcome in every way.
How often do you tend to go back to a ballet in terms of the programming? When does it come back in the repertory? This is just premiered in May. It's coming back in January. After January, does it tend to go in a year cycle?
we have a system at the New York City Ballet. We'll put it on the shelf for a couple of years because we have to run out of subscriptions. People have seen it. We can't give it to them again. And so probably in 2 years, we'll bring it back and we'll see how it fares, what it looks like.
Do you plan to tour with this?
We have no plans with touring. I mean, everybody has seen Romeo everywhere, you know, so we'll bring different repertoire when we tour.
And you do have in the repertory a balcony scene.
Sean Lavery, our ballet master, did his own Romeo and Juliet a number of years ago, a balcony scene, and that's fine. We can have both. I did a full-length Swan Lake, but we have Balanchine's Act II Swan Lake. So when my Swan Lake is rested, we'll do Mr. B's and vice versa.
And do you have any thoughts on what you would like to do next?
Yes, I have lots of thoughts, but do I have to share them?
But just give us a taste. Give us a hint.
Well, you know, Romeo and Juliet really, it took the better part of 2 years out of me because I really involved myself deeply in every aspect of it. And I said to myself, before the premiere even occurred, I said to myself, you know, after this, I'm just going to take a breather and I'm not going to put myself on the program for another new ballet. And so I haven't deliberately for that reason. Mm-hmm. But now I'm beginning to think about other things. Mm-hmm. And it's probably too soon for me to even say because they're not formed enough.
Mm-hmm. And when the ballet is on stage, do you see it every night? Are you there in the theater watching it every night?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And when you see something that you'd like to tinker with, you don't think, I'm going to maybe change that up later?
Yes, I do. Yeah. That's the great thing about a repertory ballet company. You have the ability to tinker. And I mean, Balanchine used to tell me this all the time. He said, you know, the big difference between us and Broadway is, he said, you know, Broadway, if you don't hit it on opening night and previews, you have previews, and opening night and they come and they kill you and you're dead. You're nothing, you have no other chance. Here, he said, we have the privilege of fixing and fixing and fixing and fixing. It's called repertory.
Did you think about Balanchine much when you were working on these dances and how he would have done something? Did those thoughts enter your mind?
You know, I think about Balanchine a lot. And as I said earlier, I thought of him a lot in the conception of this ballet with respect to Prodigal Son being an inspiration. Did I think of him in the process of choreographing it? No. Maybe subliminally. I always think of him because how good he was at everything. So he's an omnipresent, but he's not a...
Very good. Well, thank you very much. And if there's anything I didn't touch on, would you like to just have the final word?
The final word. Yes. Get your tickets.
There you go. We'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.